Blog Talk Radio.
Listeners, and thanks for joining me today. This is your host, Daria Ann, and welcome to WriteStream Tuesday. I am so excited as I have two excellent guests lined up for you this afternoon, and also good morning to my friends on the West Coast. I shouldn't neglect to say good morning because, especially since both of my authors today are on the West Coast where it is still morning. So greetings, everyone. Happy St. Joseph's Day. If you don't know what that is, you can visit my blog at dariadgiovanni.com, where I just put up a quick post about it. And before I get to my first author, Cherry Tigress, who I see is on the line, I just wanted to quickly let everyone know about what's been going on at WriteStream this week. I am the founder of the WriteStream Radio Network and the WriteStream Twitter chat. And this past week on the WriteStream Radio Network, which features two other hosts, we have the wonderful Lisa Tarvis, who is a spiritualist, a metaphysician, and an intuitive. And her show airs every Sunday on the WriteStream Network, and it's called Just Believe. This past Sunday, she had an excellent guest, author Dr. Karen Wyatt, MD, who wrote a book based on her experiences working at hospice. And in case you're wondering, it actually was a very uplifting interview. And although I haven't read the book, Lisa made the point that she expected the book to be, she thought the book might be a little depressing for some people, and it actually turned out to be very uplifting. So I highly recommend checking out the archive of that interview. And also yesterday, our Military Monday host, military historian and journalist John D. Gresham, interviewed a wonderful author and Air Force veteran, Robert F. Doerr, and they had a very fascinating discussion. So I encourage you to go ahead and listen to that when you have the time. And to listen to all of the shows in our archives at WriteStream, just go to blogtalkradio.com/WriteStream. And that's the word write, WriteStream, WriteStream, all one word. Coming up this week on the WriteStream weekly Twitter chat, which takes place on Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, our featured guest is Budapus Publishing, and you can find them, you can follow her on Twitter, at Budapus, B-U-D-D-H-A-P-U-S-S, and they represent such wonderful authors as Marty Odell Ingridson, who I interviewed last week about her new book, Sweet William, a novella, which I highly recommend, and also my friend Mariam Cobrith, who's actually in the middle of completing the third book in her trilogy, the first of which, The Distant Shore, I reviewed on my blog. And Mariam will actually be one of my guests next Tuesday on WriteStream. So please check all of that out. Follow us on Twitter using hashtag WriteStream. And you know, feel free to contact me if you have any suggestions for guests or any way that we can improve the show. But right now, I want to just go ahead and introduce my first guest, author Cherry Tigris. And she was actually introduced to me by my good friend Carla Salvo, who is an author with Andante Publishing and also Piccolina Publishing. And Carla's book is called Just Say the Word, and I reviewed it a couple of years ago, interviewed her, and she's been just such an invaluable resource in introducing me to other fantastic authors, Cherry being one of them. And I completed Cherry's book, Toilet Paper People, about a week or so ago and posted a review on my blog. And I have to tell you, it was one of those books that just was so hard-hitting and powerful that it really stayed with me for days after reading it. But rather than me rambling on about it, I'm going to go ahead and bring on my guest, my first guest for this afternoon, author Cherry Tigris, and let her tell us all about it.
Thank you for having me today.
Hi. Hey, Cherry, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Thanks. I apologize if there's a little bit of background noise. It just seems like every time I go on the air, something out of my control is taking place outside, and right now it's somebody cutting their lawn. So hopefully
I have a bunch of cats outside my front door here, so I have the same situation.
Well, good. Well, Cherry, I want to start by, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of introduce yourself. I know you're so much more than an author, too. You're also a musician and a songwriter. So I want to go ahead and give you an opportunity to kind of introduce yourself to the audience, and then we'll get into some specific questions about your book.
Sure. Actually, I'd like to consider myself an activist of sorts. I think that my music and my book and the things that I write about all kind of come together and dovetail into a situation where I like to talk to people who've experienced child abuse, and, you know, that audience is a huge audience, and I need to reach them in a myriad of different ways. So it's my goal to help educate the world about post-traumatic stress disorder and how that affects, you know, anyone who is in their 20s to, you know, women who are in their 40s and 50s. Even I have a huge male audience as well, who deal with PTSD from child abuse-related situations. And so I've taken upon myself to really kind of be an advocate for child abuse survivors.
Wow. Well, that is wonderful, Cherry. And I have to tell you, you know, your book just, you know, as I was reading it, it was so gritty and hard-hitting and very well-written, and I was just overwhelmed with so many feelings. In my case, also, just kind of overwhelming gratitude for having a very different kind of upbringing. But tell me a little bit about, you know, the writing process, and how long after you had gotten yourself out of that horrible situation, you know, take us through that process. How long did it take, and when did you decide to write this book, and how did you go about it?
Sure. It took me many years because for at least the first few years, you're in a survival kind of mode where, you know, everybody else would like to call them, you know, young, at-risk youth who are homeless by different circumstances. And I really never considered myself homeless. I considered myself this being on the planet. And so for many years, I was in varying stages of denial about what had happened to me. I definitely didn't believe a lot of the memories that were coming back. And it wasn't until I had a court-appointed official actually interview my adoptive mom until I really realized that some of the more serious memories I had were indeed true. And once that happened, I knew that, you know, I was tasked with this mission to talk about the truth and the ways that we use to hide the truth. So, you know, there were many years where I just refused to talk about that woman. I refer to that woman as my mom. And I would make things up so that I would appear more normal. And that just didn't sit well with me. And I decided, you know, the truth would set me free and I would actually deal with these memories. I went to several different therapists to make sure that the things that I was recalling were true. And once that happened, that's when I knew that I had this obligation to stand up for the people who also have stories that they are either hiding or not able to come to terms with. I hope that answers your question.
Right. No, no, that is excellent. And I have to tell you, I mean, your book is such a powerful testament to the human spirit and its ability to overcome even the worst of circumstances. And I have to say, Cherry, I mean, reading some of that stuff, it was just mind-blowing to me that one human being, especially someone's, you know, alleged mother, could be so unspeakably cruel to their own child. And, I mean, just some of the things that you describe in the book were just, like I said, very just eye-opening and just shocking. And
right.
So what was it like trying to, now once you remember some of these things, I mean, was it difficult to write about them and relive them?
Yes, it was really difficult. And I'll tell you that, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder plays out in many different ways. And one of those ways is I was actually reading an article about the Botox mom. If you remember back to that big story about the woman who was having her daughter go through Botox at a ridiculously ungodly age of, like, what, 6 or 10 or something like that?
Oh my God.
When I was like, oh, my God, right? Like, I remembered the bleaching. I remembered that woman, my mom, having this ridiculous amount of, in her mind, pressure to have me live up to her ideals or to a society's ideals. And so that's when I realized that, you know, yes, I have to write about it. Yes, it's tough. But, you know, I've always believed in a higher calling, really. I mean, to some, that's God. For me, it's the universe that, you know, I'll be okay, that, you know, I can write about this stuff. I've really been fortunate to surround myself with really good people who have been supportive of me during the writing process. Because, yeah, I mean, almost impossible to write about. But once it was out, I was able to really deal with it. And that's another coping kind of skill I've learned is, you know, we're going to have these memories, especially child abuse survivors, and they're going to be awful and we're not going to believe them. You know, find the right kind of psychotherapy. And in a lot of ways, I was a street kid for many years, so I didn't have those resources. But I did have a pencil and I did have a piece of paper and I wrote about it. I created the toilet paper people out of nothing, you know. And it's about
right.
being resourceful, you know. And so the story wasn't really bleak in my mind. The story was fascinating because I was able to create this fantasy land. And you can duplicate that way of thinking over and over again because I've never felt poor. I've always felt, you know, like a champion for those who don't have as many resources.
Well, you know, Cherry, my hat is off to you. I mean, I cannot tell you how much admiration and respect I have for you because, you know, I certainly understand how you feel and where you're coming from. But for somebody like me who was reading your book who, you know, didn't experience all those things, it's just it fills you with such tremendous admiration. I'm sure all readers who read your book will feel the same way towards you. I mean, it's just amazing how you were able to overcome all of this. And it's inspiring, too, how you're using that experience to kind of reach out and help other people. You know, tell anyone listening, for our listeners, why the title Toilet Paper People and how did they evolve in your childhood experience?
Thank you for the great question. With regards to toilet paper people, I started having these memories of, you know, I mean, how do I forget the toilet paper people, first of all? But as I started getting older, I realized, you know, the more I talk about what had happened to me, the more people were kind of distancing themselves from me because they didn't know how to handle it. Because those memories are pretty tough, right? I mean, you experienced it in reading the book and, you know, as do many others. I realized that toilet paper people are throwaway people. They're people we discard because we don't understand or we can't relate to them because we automatically think that they're disposable in some way, shape, or form, but it's something we use every single day. And I just thought that was a great way of describing not only the people who got me out of a scary situation, you know, but people that know how to endure. And while I had to throw a lot of them away, the memory of them really endured for me, and it was that memory alone that always reminded me that, you know, I can create myself anything to get out of this situation so that I can do the right things in the right ways for people. And that, I guess, they gave me my strength. So toilet paper people is something that's easy to remember. You know, like we toilet paper houses. We toilet paper people the way that we toilet paper houses when we are not comfortable with the subject matter like child abuse. And the act of recreating these people was inherently the thing that got me out of the awful things that my foster or my adoptive mom was doing to me. And, you know, I was really fortunate to meet the leader of the Cambodian freedom fighters. He wrote the book Tomorrow I'm Dead, and we shared a lot of the same kind of experiences. You know, he said, go out to the woods and make it happen for yourself. In a lot of ways, child abuse survivors are like that. You know, they're thrown away, and they're told, make something of your life, right, out of nothing. Make something out of your life out of nothing. And I believe that we can do that if we're given the proper coping skills. And it's my, I feel it's my job as Cherry Tigress and the author of this book to not just make this about the book, but make this about championing the causes of child abuse survivors and that they are people too, and they are not always at risk. They're not always the people that we need to be afraid of. They're the people who are going to take care of us at the end of the day, really, because we really want to have a sense of family that a lot of people take for granted. So I think that's kind of my message with the book, and I'm not sure if that's the message you got, but it was definitely what I had intended.
Oh, no, absolutely that comes across, Cherry, and I want to give a shout-out to Boon Yam, too, because his book, Tomorrow I'm Dead, is one of my favorites, and I'm glad you brought him up, and I can definitely see the parallels between your two experiences.
For sure.
It's that power, that ability, I think, in each one of us. It's so inspiring to me that no matter how drastic your circumstances are, maybe they're not quite as drastic as what you describe in the book, but, you know, we're all dealing with issues, and I think anybody reading your book will be inspired that, wow, if this person, you know, if this girl can overcome that, then I can certainly, you know, kind of dig deep within and find the same way, find the same survival skill.
For sure. And I've had some amazing experiences with people who've read the book where they've said, you know, I read your book and I was having this issue with my mom and I thought it, you know, she was so terrible for this, that, or the other. And, you know, I read your book and I called my mom and we're working on it. You know, going to be okay. And, you know, it's like, it's not just people who've, you know, had it as serious as me. Because the story isn't how bad the child abuse was. The story is how fascinating the toilet paper people were. You know, and that regardless of what the human circumstance, you know, we all want real relationships with something. And we try to seek out those meaningful relationships. And I've been really fortunate that, you know, I've been getting the reviews I've been getting, but, you know, it's not, I'm really excited that you read the book and found this meaningful, you know, in your life. You said that it brought you that kind of appreciation for your upbringing, you know, and maybe there's change there.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's. I think in my case, and I think there are a lot of people out there like this, you kind of just, you know, you take things for granted. Now, certainly as I've grown and come across other people, you do discover that not everybody has had been as blessed with the same circumstances. And I'm not suggesting that my family is perfect, but, you know, you realize, like, wow, on all the things that matter, yeah, you were pretty lucky, you know. And so that's, I mean, that's one of the biggest gifts I think your book offers for people like me. But also, like I said, again, just that appreciation for the human spirit and what it can really overcome, and certainly, you know, filled me with a lot of admiration for you. Now, Cherry, what has been the reaction from other people who have endured similar situations to yours, to the book?
Most of the reactions are, you know, I don't feel so alone anymore. You know, I get a lot of child abuse survivors who email me and say, you know, I thought I was the only one who was dealing with this feeling of aloneness and this feeling of judgment. So a lot of child abuse survivors will cloak themselves in more, I mean, in normal roles, right? A lot of us decide, you know, hey, we're going to be the best mother ever, considering what I've been through. But, you know, that aloneness still carries on no matter what you've done with your life after child abuse. And so a lot of these child abuse thrivers, really, will email me and say, thank you for talking about the things no one really wants to talk about with me. You know, like the nights underneath the sheets where I wept silently because I was so afraid that that woman would hear me, right? Like, who is listening to that child? Does anyone ever listen to that child, or do we go on and just cope with the wounds of child abuse and abandonment without ever having those things recognized? So it's been really, really wonderful to get the emails I've gotten from child abuse survivors who feel like they're not judged anymore or as much, because it really is my goal to go all the way with this book in terms of, you know, I'm going to talk about where is the accountability for the child abusers. Like, the story is always, oh, you know, this or that happened to this kid, and isn't it great? But you know what? What happened to the parents who abused these kids? You know, these people get off every single day of the week, and we let them. And I wonder if that has anything to do with our human trafficking problem. You know? Yeah, you know,
wow.
It makes one wonder.
No, that is an excellent point, Sherry. And what, I mean, if you don't mind my asking, were the people who hurt you ever held responsible?
No, they weren't. The statute of limitations had run out on my case. I had had a court-appointed official interview my foster mom, well, my adoptive mom, and they had asked her, you know, did this happen? And not only did she admit that it happened, she started justifying it. Well, what was a good mom to do? And it was pretty sick. And so what happened was this court-appointed official suggested that I write this book, and that was when it all started for me. I was like, you know, there's no way I will ever be able to hold them accountable, but I'm going to write this book.
Well, good for you. Now, have you,
yeah.
I mean, has she ever tried to reach out to you in any way?
I was encouraged by well-meaning people to reach out to them, which was probably the worst thing I ever did, and that's something I could be writing about in my next book.
Oh, okay.
So,
wow. I'm sure that's
the people
going to be
who
another...
believe that. Forgiveness. So forgiveness is a huge topic with me. I get a lot. I mean, almost 80% of my emails come from people who talk about the importance of forgiveness. And while I've let a lot of my child abuse history go, I believe forgiveness is for those who are asking for forgiveness. It's not something we should just grant someone. So.
Yeah, and I I mean, you know, and anyone listening, I mean, please get a copy of Sherry's book. You can get it at Amazon.com. And I read it in paperback. Now, Sherry, is it also available like in ebook format as well?
It is. It's available on Kindle. I just checked the link on my website, so we're good on that. It's also, I've discounted it to $4.99 today, just for anyone who's listening. So that's going on. And I'm also scheduling the West Coast book tour right now. In San Francisco, we're talking to the people at City Lights. I believe my manager is talking to Powell's right now in Portland. And so hopefully I'll be everywhere within the next month.
Wow, that's fantastic. And I just, you know, brought up where to get your book, not simply as a promotion, but also for people to understand that when they do read it, I can, you know, having read your book, I can fully understand where you're coming from with forgiveness because, you know, and I think in my case, I could, you know, trying to put myself in your situation, unless the person came groveling back to me begging for it, and even then, I don't quite know if I'd be able to muster it within myself after reading, you know, what you went through, what this horrible, sick woman put you through. It's just, and the fact that she's still in denial about it is stunning.
Right. I just hope that she's able, and honestly, you know, they were a huge part of their Catholic church, and they were giving a lot of donations to the church, and I believe that in a lot of ways fueled the engine. She felt that it was okay to keep on doing the things because no one ever called her on it, because they were being paid to stay in business or whatever, and it's just like those same people were the first ones to tell me how important forgiveness was. And I just think it's an important part of the conversation that, you know what, all of this conversation could be had about all of these stories because the second I put my book out, I've heard worse stories than the one I've been through, you know.
Oh,
and I want the conversation to be about what do we do to the people who've actually done this damage. You know, I mean, how do we hold them accountable in a public way so that, you know, I believe that if we shame these people, that they will not be as likely to do it. And it's until we as a society decide that it's important enough to call the people on their bullshit, Sorry, I said that bad word.
Okay. internet radio. We're good.
Okay, great. I just hope that, you know, we're able to shift the focus. That's a big part of what I'm doing is, you know, how do we stand up? So the only difference in my situation, as you'll read in my book, is that I stood up to her. And it was the day that I stood up to her was the day that changed my life. And I'll never forget that. I want to cope young people in the, you know, who are in situations like that with the skills necessary. I'm a very little person. The fact I was able to do what I did in that situation was not something that is humanly possible. That's why every day I am very thankful to this higher calling to allow me to keep on going and advocating for people like me to really hold these child abusers accountable for the damage they've done to our lives.
Yep, and I have to say, Cherry, I was cheering you on in that scene. I was just like, yeah, finally, good, you know, and I think other people are going to have the same reaction when they read that. And you brought up a really good point, you know, in terms of, you know, the church and other adults who kind of let you down. You know, hypocrisy, I think, is another big theme in the book. And let me ask you, I mean, do you feel that there were people who knew what was going on and they just chose to look the other way? For example, the church, because, you know, your adoptive parents were given the money and that was really all they cared about, and they might have raised an eyebrow, maybe you had a suspicion something was going on, but nobody did anything because they didn't want to upset the apple cart kind of thing. Is that what was going on?
I think that that woman, my adoptive mom, did a really good job of covering it. So if you remember in the chapter Corduroy and Turtlenecks about the pre-stamped, you know, Christmas tree turtlenecks, yeah, and all of this, you know, I think that inherently we're a narcissistic culture. And so a lot of these women who came to my house really, honestly, just they were so involved with themselves that they might have missed it. Because my mom did a good job of cloaking me in outfits where you couldn't see the scars on my arms. You know, the people at church, you know, my parents were paying a huge amount of money to the church in the community we lived in. So no one would be willing to call them on it. My adoptive dad was an attorney, so there was that layer of fear. So I think this level of child abuse happens in homes that aren't just homes that are struggling, but in really, you know, higher-end kind of communities, you know. And I think it's just about waking up. It's waking up to, hey, it's not all about me. What's going on next door? And really having the grits and the courage to see the suffering of a young child. And a lot of people don't have the, you know, they're not able to, nor are they willing to risk that. So I really believe the true help happens to the young adults who have suffered the child abuse, so they don't become the offenders, right? So I think it's just...
Exactly.
I hope I'm making sense.
No, you're making perfect sense, Cherry. And I wanted to say that was another thing that really stood out to me about your whole situation was that, you know, people like me who maybe aren't familiar with it. I mean, certainly we've heard about child abuse. We've seen stories occasionally in the news about it. But you tend to assume that most of these kids come from very poor backgrounds where maybe money is the issue or somebody, you know, and alcoholism.
Right.
I know that kind of played a part in your book. But, you know, you don't envision an abused child as coming from an upper middle class neighborhood, you know, where
right.
we've got, you know, professional parents, you know, working and, you know, with all the sort of trappings of quote unquote success. So I think that was another thing that stood out to me. And then certainly since we brought up, you know, the adoptive father, I wanted to say that I was just so angry as I was reading that, you know, that this man who was, you know, supposedly your father, just, you know, recognized what was going on but just kind of chose to turn a blind eye to it, and he was able to escape every day. But
well,
you know,
he was
defenseless, and that really pissed me off. Go ahead.
Yeah, and, you know, I've really had the most amount of conflict around this issue because if you remember early in the book, at any point my mother could have accused him of molesting me. And back then, it was definitely a situation where people, and even now, believe that the father would be molesting me because I was not, you know, I was not their child. I was, you know, an adoptive child. And she held that over his head a lot. So at any point, she could have said, he's molesting our daughter, boo-hoo me. And, you know, that was in her repertoire of vindictive behavior, and that's also a very relevant theme nowadays. I hear a lot of men saying, I was with my ex way too long because she threatened to say that I was molesting our daughter. My dad never laid a hand on me. And while he was a complete and ultimate coward in a lot of situations, I think she held the card. She held the one card that she could use against him at any point and would sink everything, not only for him, but for all of us. I've never really been able to completely come to terms with his part in this. I just think it's, hey, how can we handle these young adults who've been abused as children so that they don't become angry adults abusing their children? You know?
Right. Break that cycle.
Yeah, big time. And, humans are going to be humans at the end of the day. And a lot of people were not expecting that I would stand up and fight back. And yes, I'm angry at my dad for not doing more to protect me and not, it was very convenient for him to not believe me. He's a top attorney in his field even now. And I'm taking a huge risk, but you know what? So what? I'm going to do it. Regardless of what that costs me.
Well, no, and again, kudos for that. I'm just, I'm very proud of you, Carrie. I don't, we've only known each other a short time through email and now first time speaking, but
I'm
telling you again, just your book is just such a testament to your strength, and I just can't tell you that enough.
Thank you.
But another thing I wanted, because we mentioned, that you were an adopted child. Well, one, before I even get into that, I was listening to you speak, and even under, more quote-unquote normal circumstances, I think the court system tends to automatically favor the mother, even in this day and age, even if the mother's in the wrong, and even if there's not even child abuse involved. So I'm glad you clarified that, because, that is an important point in kind of taking a more of a well-rounded approach, I guess, at looking at, the adoptive father in the story. But secondly, the fact that you were an adopted child, too, I think most people would assume, well, wow, if somebody's adopted, they must have really been wanted, So I think a lot of people would assume, well, how could an adoptive child, not that it's impossible to be abused, but I think that's another stereotype that your book probably shatters.
Yeah, it definitely does, because my adoptive mom wanted me as part of how she was identifying herself to her socialite friends. So a lot of the abuse, the stuff that I really had the hardest time coping with, had to do with her competitive nature. So she needed me as almost like she needs a pair of nice shoes or a purse. And so as long as I was filling that ideal for her, and everything was never fine because I never fit that ideal entirely. That was the root of the problem. She didn't really want me because she didn't want to get to know me. I didn't even get to know me until like last year, right? Because we're all trying to fill this role. And so she needed a role of daughter as played on General Hospital. And that was what was comfortable for her. That's what she felt she needed to present to her groups of friends. And so I've always had this kind of, I don't belong to that because I'm me and I don't make chocolate chip cookies perfectly. I don't have blonde hair because you have blonde hair. I have dark hair, and that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with me. That means that I'm different than you. And, it just goes on and on from there. It's, be confident in who you are as a mom and be confident enough to want to get to know your daughter as an independent person from you. And that was never what happened in our relationship.
Now, Cherry, were you adopted in infancy?
Yes. I was born in San Francisco, and I don't know the details because the files are locked. So I have to get to San Francisco, and I need to actually have a judge petition the court to open my adoption records, which is another big thing with me, is I think adoptive children should feel like they can get their records without having to petition the court.
Yeah. Now is approaching your birth mother something you want to do, I take it?
If that happens, that's great. I think one of the things I learned in writing the book was I'm a person of this earth, independent of who my mom is. So it would be great if that happens organically, but I'm not going to push it. I think once we go into any relationship, feeling that there's a need to be in the relationship, I think that taints it in some ways. So if we find our way to one another, that's going to be beautiful, and I'd love to have that happen. But I'm not sitting here, you know, with any kind of expectation around it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and if it does happen, you can write about that experience. That would be fascinating.
I know, right? Like, I'm just so the fact that right now my manager is someone who's very involved in horses, and I, you know, one of the stories that was playing out that is not in the book is that my real mom is from Kentucky, and I just think Kentucky Derby, and it's something I've always wanted to do. So that's on my bucket list, is to go to Kentucky and hopefully find her.
It's kind of like it's in your DNA then, a love of horses.
The fact that horses keep finding me, and if we stay still long enough, the right things will find us. The toilet paper people found me, and that's just kind of a really big theme in the book. Is, you know, this is not just a story about child abuse; it's a story of human triumph and sitting still and waiting for the universe to work its magic, because it will, if we stop.
Yeah.
You know, always being on Facebook and always connecting, maybe if we sit down for a second, the right things will find us.
Well, that is excellent advice, Jerry. And I just for anyone listening to it, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but I have to tell us, if you don't mind, like tell the audience how the toilet paper people came about. I know you were denied toys by your adoptive mom.
Right.
And I have to tell you, one of my favorite characters was Fred, too. So I want to talk about Fred a little bit.
Yeah, totally.
Ahead, sorry.
I will. No, it's good. It's great. So it all transpired because she had staged this room, and home staging, as that became popular in our culture, it just horrified me that there would be a room that's staged. But she had staged my room the way that she had thought a little girl's room should be. But I wasn't allowed to touch anything. And, you know, one day, because she would leave me there for many, many, you know, days in a row, I was in there and I had found a funny little box, and I decided that I would take a look inside, and that's when I found out that I was adopted or foster or whatever that was, because I found a note from my real mom. And she was so furious that that woman, my foster mom, was so furious that I had found this box and I had found out the truth, that she gutted the entire room of anything that I could actually learn or you know, have fun with. And so she left me pretty much with a roll of toilet paper. And so with that toilet paper, I would create these little toilet paper people. And the very earliest generations didn't have any spines to them. But as I became more resourceful, I would actually dig through our trash and find the garbage twisty ties. And I would start tying the toilet paper to these twisty ties. And I would create these, you know, little dolls for myself. And from that, I decided I would create one of the best dolls ever, and his name is Fred. And Fred was the one that I spent the most time with. I actually started tying candy wrappers to Fred, and, you know, I found all sorts of ways to make him brilliant. And that was just my little fantasy land. I just decided, you know, I'm not going to be the kid who doesn't have dolls. You know, I need to relate to something, for crying out loud, because I'm not going to relate to all of these stupid things she's put in my room. And that's kind of how the toilet paper people were created.
Wow, that's amazing.
And you can see an example
of
Fred on the cover of the book.
That's right. It's a beautiful cover, Cherry. And did you hire someone to create the cover for you? How did that work out? Because it's very, very appealing.
Thank you. There are two layers to the cover. I want to thank Lily Kilbear. She's my energy healer. She was in Mount Shasta when I was recording some of my music, and she had recreated Fred. So she had had this dream. She was like, oh, my God, I couldn't resist. I had to create Fred. And so I took a picture of Fred. That picture and her energy has carried on. I refuse to have a cover that does not in some way carry her energy, and it does. And so I created all the graphics around the cover and the layout myself.
Oh, it's beautiful. And again, everyone listening, and if you're listening in the archives, please go to Cherry's website, cherrytigris.com, cherrytigris.com, and check it out. And you can also purchase the book at amazon.com.
Thank you so much.
Oh, no, no, but we still have some time here, Cherry. So I just, it's so funny. I had another question that came into my mind, and it just went out the second, you know, the second I stopped to do that little promo. But no, I love the cover, and I just, I know what I wanted to say next. I mean, you were saying your mother, when I was reading this in the book, how she would just, you know, leave you in your room for days at a time. I mean, now, without anything to drink or eat, I'm assuming, you know, and certainly comes out in the book
food
that you're hungry.
I was shocked myself at how many references to food are in this book. I was like, oh my God, I'm making myself hungry, right? Each chapter there's some reference to me stealing food. I mean, I don't know, is that what you were kind of talking to?
Well, yeah, I mean, she's this woman purposely starved you, and the irony, of course, is that, as you're reading the book, she's, busy making, whatever recipe in her Williams-Sonoma bowls or in her designer kitchen, and yet she's starving her own daughter, and she's making all these fancy meals, and it seemed like in the book that you weren't really the recipient of her, culinary skills very often.
She was an amazing cook. It was really shocking, actually. And it was a power trip, really. It was, and sometimes it was because she forgot. Like, I really do believe that whatever it was she was taking and the alcohol, and as a kid, I really couldn't put those two into, I wouldn't put those two together, right? So, imagine she was drinking a lot. She was medicating herself. We know that prescription drug abuse is a huge problem in this country. And she used the drugs and the alcohol to take away the pain from what was going on with my dad. And she felt the need to be Mrs. Perfect. And in a lot of ways, to the outside world, she was. And her not feeding me was more of one of two things. Her being too drunk and medicated to realize that she had forgotten to feed me or had forgotten that I was up in this room. So when she would bleach me, so that's another chapter, she was busy, engaged in her soap operas and cooking. I mean, that was her comfort. And if you get so lost to your own comfort, you forget about the person who's sitting in this room wanting to please you, because all I wanted to do was participate in her cooking. She wouldn't let me participate because she couldn't handle anything being done the wrong way. And I tried to do a good job of outlining that need for a process. That process of, there's only one way to clean things, right? So she had written down it all down on a piece of paper. And it was just this constant, this is the way we do things every time. And what if I said, hey, maybe we shouldn't clean today. Let's go do something else. She could never break away from that schedule. And I think it's important. I mean, it's a bigger statement about our society and our need for that structure, that real, I don't know how to explain it. It's almost obsessive need for structure.
Oh, yeah.
That defines us. And the deeper you get into that, and then you add drugs and alcohol, you've got someone who cannot handle chaos. And I think some of the best moms, just based on what I've experienced in my life after child abuse, are the ones who are completely chaotic because they realize their kids are human, right? And they've got crap on the walls, right? Like, I couldn't touch anything in my house, And I love a couch that has a few chocolate smudges,
Yeah.
Or crayon on the millwork. I mean, that's all, those are human things. And I really discovered in my later life that anything too perfect scares me. Because that person is not truly identified with the dirtiness of the human condition. So,
No, that's the truth. That came through loud and clear that woman couldn't handle, the imperfection of life at all. And, mm-hmm. it's just absurd. And, she came across to me as also being, when you said obsessive, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, to me, she came across as, in addition to her many other issues, as having OCD. I've known one person who was a hoarder. It was just, even though it might seem like the opposite extreme, it's actually kind of like another end of the same, along the same spectrum. It's the same compulsion, but just expressing itself in a different way. But I've also known people who are so, like, obsessively compulsive about things that, that even the cans of tuna have to be lined up perfectly.
I can't watch Sleeping with the Enemy. I cannot watch that movie.
Sure.
The one with Julia Roberts and that crazy
movie.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that movie.
I can't watch that movie. I mean, there are lots of things like that. And, you know, I also want to say, had we, you know, in that chapter where I'm talking about Easter and the Easter baskets, right? Like, she was going to create the Easter baskets of all Easter baskets, right? Like, that was her design. And at any point, I mean, my parents were so loaded, right, in terms of money. Like, she could have just, you know, do your own Easter basket. That's great. Give the kid the cheap-ass Easter basket that they want. You know, like,
right.
I mean,
yeah.
Honestly, it was like $5 for a stupid Easter basket. And, you know, if you don't like the looks of it, put me up in the room with this Easter basket. So what I wound up doing was taking the foil from all of those Cadbury bunny eggs or whatever, and I created costumes for my toilet paper people. And it's like to find a way to make it right is inherent in the human condition, right? Like to want
yeah.
to have your own version of delight. And to rob that from a child, you know, like, I mean, yeah, you can have your moss-colored grass from Martha Stewart. That's great, right? But you know, my daughter is really wanting that flashy plastic grass. That's okay. You know, it shouldn't be this really definitive line of what's right and wrong. You know, I mean, it's all right. All of it is all right. I mean, we are all our own human beings, and it's not this ownership of this is my child and this is the way my child's going to act, you know, or I'm going to lock her in a room and I'm going to pretend she doesn't exist. And that happens to a lot of families who are too caught up in the way things look like and the way things should sound like. So that's
yeah,
scary
they're too caught
me.
Up in the way other people perceive, you know, perceive them and not focused enough on the needs of their own kids and again, like having a tolerance for life's imperfections, which really aren't, like you're saying, little kids, they love those cheap Easter baskets. Who cares? Like, it would have been so easy for her to just let you have what you wanted. Like you said,
absolutely.
Keep it in the room. She could have the fancy one to show off to her friends, but she didn't have that innate ability. Well, there was obviously the woman had zero compassion or even
yeah,
interest in what would make you happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think, Cherry, there were many cool scenes in the book, but I think, like, the three that stood out to me, and really I think the one that really just shocked me the most was, you know, the scene where she was just freaking out at you because, you know, God forbid you hadn't gotten your period when the other girls in the neighborhood had gotten theirs. And I think, like, I mean, and it's hard to really choose one because there are so many horrible, vicious scenes in the book. But, I mean, that one just really... I don't know, that one just really hit me, and I just wondered if you wanted to speak a little bit about that and, you know.
Sure. It was the one that she admitted. It was the one that the court-appointed official wanted to know about because they considered it rape, which was interesting to me, and I'm still coming to terms with how I feel about using the word rape in terms of that particular scene. I think that the fact that, you know, this is about female relationships. I mean, at least some of this book has to do with female relationships and, you know, how things should be. And when you put how things should be with a biological occurrence, right, like how can we predict when someone should have, you know, a certain life thing like having a period? How do you control that? And why is it that this woman was so obsessive about being, you know, she wanted a talking point. So she wanted to be able to talk about the fact that her daughter had her period. And, you know, it was just difficult for me because that was not something, it was definitely not something I could control myself. So when she would ask me every single day, have you gotten it yet? I didn't know what she was talking about. You know?
Uh-huh.
Right? I'm just like, have I gotten it yet? I don't think so. Right? Like, okay, so, I mean, if I could get this thing that you really want any sooner, I'd do it for you. And to feel like she felt that she could circumvent that process, that was really sick. And I just, that brought about another memory that was tougher for me to really accept. And so it's just, what are these things that we're doing? What are these things that we need to do to control other people because we have certain expectations about the way things should be? That was the most massive of all of them. You know, the fact that
yeah.
she thought she could control my period by raping me or, you know. So what she did was, to the audience who has not read this particular chapter yet, she wanted to make sure that my period would come, so she used tampons to make sure that that would happen. And that was just, it's sad, but I had my toilet paper people. So believe it or not, Fred sat up in the cabinet, and when she drove away, I needed to really dig deep inside myself and realize that I would be able to endure this memory, that I would be able to live on to another day. And they really helped me do that. Had I not had that fantasy, I probably would have become victim to what she had wanted out of me. So I don't know if that helped explain that situation.
No, it did, Sherry. Not to say, I mean, it certainly was a violation of your dignity at the very least, you know, whether or not you want to, you know, if you're comfortable with the term rape, but it certainly was a gross violation of your personal dignity. And I think that's what really, I think that's why it really hit me and stood out to me the most. And like I said, it was tough competition throughout the book because there were so many just horrific things that she did to you. But I just, for some reason, that one just really got to me, and it does, and you're right, it speaks to female relationships, which brings me to another point. What was it like for you, as far as, like, your classmates and peers at school, did you have any girlfriends or anyone that you could confide in that really was loyal to you and understood you and expressed some compassion?
To be really honest, I didn't know really how abnormal things were for me until I started getting into my teens. But I did, the friend that I did have that actually witnessed the abuse in my household was a girl named Amy. She is the only, well, there are two people in the book who were named by name and are actually their names. And that's because they're not guilty. Right? And that's
right.
Amy.
Good.
So, yeah, Amy was a girlfriend that I had had since, elementary school, and she actually wound up continuing on into high school with me. And what was really great about Amy was that she didn't ask a lot of questions. She inherently knew that something was amiss. And so she never put me in a situation where I felt like I would get in trouble for telling, because I was mandated by that woman, my mom, to not talk about anything. So I think the thought that kids in their teens or even in elementary school will talk about the abuse, there's no way I would have talked about what was going on. Like, I knew that something worse than what had already happened would happen. No one had been successful to that point in stopping that from happening. So, you know, there's no way I think Amy could get me out of it. But Amy certainly made things better. So what would happen was we had these during lunch, some of us would actually go out and actually go to Burger King, and she would make sure that I got to Burger King to get my chicken sandwiches that I would stockpile in my backpack so that I'd have food to eat. So I would actually layer the chicken patties in my backpack and bring them home
wow.
from school with me and hide them so that I would have something to eat for the week. And so she knew I was doing that, but I never really gave her all of the reasons why, and so it was really interesting to see, you know, another teenager see what was going on with me without putting me in further jeopardy. And I think that's important. That's another important message that I want to give to people who are, you know, hey, I know something's going on with that kid, and not automatically think that this kid is at risk. To be honest with you, that has really done a lot of damage to child abuse survivors, because the only thing I was ever at risk of was hurting myself because I didn't know how to handle what was going on at home, you know, because I'm the most giving person on the planet, you know.
Well, right, and it seems like if, you know, because it's such a, you know, we were saying earlier, you were telling me that they rarely get, if ever, get punished, these people, that would actually make things worse for a victim of child abuse. If somebody were to say something and then you end up, you know, nothing would happen and you know, the abuser would then take it out on you even worse. It sounds like.
Big time, and they're taking a big risk by telling. So there was a teacher who stood in my defense at some point in my elementary school, actually it might have been my freshman year in high school, who got fired because she had, you know, said, hey, you know, she should really join cheerleaders or whatever other after-school activity. So what I'm trying to say is we really reach those child abuse survivors when they've left the homes that they were in. So I'm not going to give anything away in my book. But it's really interesting that some people will lay in wait to help you. So identifying who those people are, right? They're not asking you the questions to get themselves in trouble or you in trouble, but they have outreach to you so you know how to get a hold of them when you do run away. That's super
right.
important because the resources out there, there aren't resources out there. Everything is overflowed right now. And to know what independent private parties are out there to help you, oh, my God, had it not been for this one individual, I never would have gotten to college. You know, I was able to pay, you know, I was able to get into college. I was able to work at Tower Records to help pay for most of my college, right? And it's just that get up and go, you know, like I'm not a victim of child abuse. You know, I'm a child abuse survivor, but I'm an individual in my own right, thanks to those people who believed in me enough to help take care of me in ways that my parents never could.
Wow. So what would be your advice then if there's somebody listening who suspects there's a child that they know that might be enduring the same situation, what should they do if they want to help in some way? Just kind of be that person that's there for the child if and when they come to them. I mean, because I think people do have good intentions, the people that recognize what's going on and they want to do something to help.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering if you had any advice for those kinds of people out there.
Well, I definitely think that making sure that the child has your email address or phone number. You don't need to go into details about, you know, hey, I know something might be going on if you ever need me for anything. To try or attempt to go after the parents who are abusing the kid, you know, DSHS can't do what they need to do because they're just overtaxed with people. So they need to know that, yeah, those 1-800 numbers really don't work. I'm sorry, they didn't work for me at the time. They may work now. But to have someone else outside of that to call and say, hey, can you pick me up at the hotel? Can you pick me up at wherever? You know, I know that had I not had that kind of contact information for the person who helped me when I left, I never would have been able to get there. I wouldn't have had that destination. So I think it's realizing that there's very little DSHS can do to go against these families. It's great to write a report and all of that, but to have that expectation that, you know, these resources are really going to help these kids, I think that's difficult. So I think if you're willing to help this kid, that means you're going to open your door and you're going to say, stay with us. We'll give you food and shelter.
Right, right.
I mean, you make sure that kid has your email address and phone number, and it's that simple. It really is. Back then, I didn't have email. We didn't have internet. Yeah, I'm dating myself.
That's okay.
But I knew
I'm right there with you, I think.
Right? I knew what her address was. I knew, you know, how to, get to her home so that they could take care of me. You know, it's that simple.
Well, excellent. Well, Terry, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And just for anyone listening, before we sign off, let everybody know how they can reach you on social media.
For sure. Okay. So on Facebook, you can find me as Cherry Tigris, like the river, T-I-G-R-I-S. You can find me the book at www.toiletpaperpeople.com. The book's available on Amazon, Amazon Kindle. It's soon to be available at City Lights, Powell's, and Barnes & Noble. So we're working on all of those avenues. But you can reach me also at info@toiletpaperpeople.com if you're interested in booking me for an appearance to talk about the book. I'm completely available. And Daria, thank you so much for opening this conversation. You are a rock star in your own right, and I'm really fortunate that we connected.
Oh, thank you, Terry. Well, I feel the same way. And listen, you have a wonderful day, and I want to bring you back on in the near future and talk about
your latest
happenings. And please, if you ever get to Florida, let me know.
You got it. I'm
on
my way.
Okay. All right, honey.
Take care. Great day. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that was the wonderful Cherry Tigris. And I see that my next guest is on the line, but I'm just going to take a very brief time out here before we get to our next interview today with Quinn Barrett. So don't go anywhere. We'll be back here in a couple of minutes.
Hi, this is Daria Ann, author and founder of the RightStream Radio Network. If you're an author, writer, blogger, or just someone who enjoys reading and learning, I hope you'll tune in to our inspiring, insightful, and educational programs. Every Sunday, join author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvez for Just Believe at 1 p.m. Eastern, when she explores a variety of spiritual topics, including alternative healing modalities. A gifted intuitive from a young age, Lisa's book, entitled Just Believe, chronicles her journey from a childhood of seeing and communicating with angels to a career in which she uses her talents to help others emotionally, spiritually, and physically. Each week, she interviews experts in the fields of personal growth, spiritual development, and alternative medicine. Military Mondays with author and military historian John D. Gresham analyzes current events and issues from the perspective of the United States military. Tune in at 1 p.m. Eastern every Monday when John, author of such books as Uncommon Valor and journalist for the Defense Media Network, interviews accomplished guests on important topics like national security and defense and global terrorism. RightStream Tuesdays with Daria Ann airs at 1 p.m. Eastern and welcomes authors in diverse genres, including romance, drama, military history, spirituality, and politics. We also speak social, discussing the benefits and pitfalls of social media platforms and the numerous and plentiful publishing formats now available with various experts in order to help other authors navigate through new technology to reach higher levels of success. During every broadcast, we welcome your calls at 347-945-7246. And of course, the chat room is always open. Can't listen live? No worries. Just go to blogtalkradio.com/rightstream to listen to the archives. And be sure to join us for our weekly Thursday RightStream Twitter chat at 11 a.m. Eastern using the hashtag RightStream on Twitter. Rejoice in the flow of creativity with the RightStream Radio Network and the RightStream Twitter chat.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the RightStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, and we are back. This is Daria Ann, your host of RightStream Tuesday, and I see that my next guest is on the switchboard. So without further ado, I want to introduce Quinn Barrett, founder of Wise Bear Media, host of the podcast Up to Speed in Digital Media News, and just an expert in e-books and e-publishing, so I really can't wait to talk to her. So, Quinn, welcome to RightStream Tuesday.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm so glad you contacted me, and I'm really thrilled to have you on the show today because I know a lot of my listeners are, you know, just aspiring authors, and myself, I first self-published 5 years ago, and God, I wish I had known then what I know now, and even now, there's so much to learn, so I'm just so thrilled to have you here. But Quinn, let's start with, why don't you just kind of give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to the audience, let us know your background, and you know how you came to become the founder of Wise Bear Media.
Sure. You had posted a lot of my bio on your page. I'm going to just kind of go from there and then fill in some of the technology stuff. I have been a book lover since I was a little girl. It was an escape for me. I grew up in what I like to call a high-maintenance organization. My parents encouraged self-care at a very young age, so books was a kind of a way of me really learning the life lessons that weren't always being instilled in my home. I thought the Laurel Ingalls Wilder, A Little House on the Prairie series, I thought they were the perfect family, and it kind of gave me goals to kind of look at, like, well, I want my life to be like this, or it helped me to make better choices in my life. So I knew, because I loved books from a young age, and I'd gotten a lot of praise from teachers for my writing skills, that it was a natural fit for me, that I always knew I was going to be an English major, although I did consider maybe going to law school or other things, but I actually happened to kind of get caught up in the technology wave just kind of by accident, and loved it. And so even though I had always planned on writing a book and had these ideas, technology kind of became on the forefront. So I was still always writing, whether it was copywriting or business plans or marketing plans or things like that. But I finally kind of got to a point when the dot-com bomb started dropping that I started kind of reevaluating my life a little bit, and I kind of was lucky and cashed in some of my stock options and started my own kind of on-site tech support firm doing web development and, like I said, helping other people. And so I was kind of really been following the kind of the blogging revolution and then the digital revolution, and it was just something that I saw as a natural extension, and it also fit in well for what my goal was to really write my own books. So my first couple attempts at writing my own manuscripts I didn't think were very good. And so it just I kind of shelved those, and maybe it wasn't the right time. And eventually I found somebody who kind of mentored me in the process and helped me to find my voice in fiction first. And loved it so much that I thought, you know, I know that as I'm helping myself, I can be of service to others. And that's kind of how the Wise Bear family of websites was created, because it represents everything that I'm passionate about: technology, business, and the written word. So,
yeah, fantastic. And I know that one of your books, and it's called Invisible Snow, and the website, if anybody wants to check that out, it's invisiblesnow.com. Just, Quinn, tell us a little bit about that book. Was that one of your first ones that you published as fiction?
That was the first one I published, and I learned a lot, made a lot of mistakes in doing it. And what's great about digital is I do plan to kind of re-release that book when I can take a breather and have time. But I'm very proud of it. It's just a little bit too long. And the one thing that I've really learned by working with others and in my own experience is that we really need to write shorter books. And the books that seem to be doing very well in the digital space are the books that are just boom, 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 follow one right after the other. So I think what is happening is writers are beginning to write like whatever they want, and then they're just cutting them up into smaller segments, pricing them at that 99 cents to 299 range, and then having more success with the smaller, you know, kind of micro-type books. But Invisible Snow is basically a classic family drama about wealth, power, greed, and redemption. It's, you know, about a couple who, you know, should have been, you know, on paper looked perfect, but they really weren't. But I also kind of throw in some of my own background and history. I was raised in the Mormon faith. I am not a member of the church any longer. And I infuse a lot of kind of my conflicts with regard to religion and things into that mix, and kind of the irony of what I feel sometimes is happening. And so there's this kind of this epic clash of wills between the two people as this woman is really kind of coming into her own and finding herself in this marriage. And so I've gotten a lot of good feedback from it, but like I said, at the end of the day, it's just too long. So I want to revamp that. And one of the things I hope to do is actually put that on a platform like Inkling or Atavist when it becomes available, so that it's really built for more of a mobile platform directly rather than just the Kindle or Smashwords platform.
Interesting. Quinn, I can relate to exactly what you're saying. I'm cracking up when you were talking about your things being too long. I mean, my book is like 435 pages, and 5 years later, that's one of the lessons I've learned, and so I'm glad that you brought that up. But also, when you were describing Invisible Snow, I was thinking of a good friend of mine who comes from a similar background. In her case, I think it was Mennonite, and ultimately decided to leave a marriage, and she was under a tremendous amount of pressure from her family. And I've always told her, you know, you really should put that into a book. I think it would really make a great story. So anyway, those were just two things that came to mind as I was listening to you. But, you know, I want to talk about, like, all of these, you know, all these new technologies and kind of get your thoughts on, you know, the publishing industry in general. And obviously, you know, you are, you know, you love technology, and you've created, you know, a career out of it. But what do you think are some of the, I guess, I mean, maybe we'll talk about some of the pitfalls and some of the benefits with new technology. And again, I think most of my listeners are kind of newbies at all of this, so I thought maybe we could kind of go through maybe some advice and some of the things that you've seen in your career and in building Wise Bear books that you might be able to impart to our audience.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, it's kind of a broad question, so if I ramble on going out in the cornfield, just pull me back real quick, because I love talking about this stuff. The main thing I see is, and I deal with a lot of people who are not particularly tech savvy. My business partner and I, we do our podcast, and it's really to kind of help educate and advocate for what's, you know, this digital paradigm that's happening. And, you know, when we look at the history of where ebooks have come from and where they're at now, we really are just barely, you know, we're barely, you know, scratching the surface here. And it reminds me of what digital software development used to be, you know, during the dot-com boom and even before that. So think about it this way. Like, do you use, is your website, like, through WordPress? Are you familiar with that? Okay. Well, most people know WordPress in some way, shape, or form, or Blogger. Those are the two main free, you know, kind of hosted platforms. And a lot of people prefer to, you know, host their own and, you know, set that all up to do that. But what happened with blogging was, and why that was such a big technology that came to the forefront, is the way that we used to have to build websites was very time-consuming and labor-intensive. It used to cost a lot of money. And then Microsoft came out with Front Page, which is what they call a WYSIWYG application, which, you know, what you see is what you get, and everybody could do that. And then from there, other people started, you know, kind of, you know, improving on it, you know, building a bigger and better mousetrap. And now we have these, you know, platforms like WordPress, Drupal, Joomla, but I think WordPress is by and large probably the easiest one and the most widely used. And, you know, it's these platforms really make it so that you can, anybody can become a publisher in with a click of a button. Okay, now we think of this in terms of pages and posts, and blogs have really transformed into what we call content management systems. So they're not just a, you know, like kind of a daily journal of, you know, what you had for breakfast or, you know, what's going on with your family. Although that is a wonderful use for it. Now imagine if you take that platform and that you could actually start writing your book in it, segmenting it by chapter, and click a button, and instead of it just going to the web, which we still want it to do, but now it can also go to your mobile device, and it's automatically formatted for, you know, an iPhone, an Android device, an iPad, a Kindle Fire. Probably Kindle's not the, you know, the Amazon's pretty proprietary about that stuff, but you get the idea. Now, wouldn't that be fun?
That's,
well, that's where I think that's where it's going.
Wow.
And there are platforms right now. Now, the problem is that most of these platforms require some knowledge of HTML, PHP, XML, or some type of coding. I happen to have some of that, so it's more exciting for me because I can actually get in there. And so I've been taking my latest book, Digital Publishing Profits, and I've been putting it up on the Inkling Habitat site. It's not released yet, but I'm playing around with it because what it allows me to do is not just put the content up there. Now it's going to allow me to put in audio or multimedia or anything that I want to put. So I'm going to use that as an example that I can then share with different authors out there and show them how to do that. So I think still for the average Joe writer that wants to use something like this, we're still a few years out and where it really becomes user-friendly. But that's the way it was with blogging. You know, blogging wasn't always as simple. It required a little bit of HTML knowledge, and now anybody can have a blog, and anybody can be published. That's eventually how books are going to be published. So everything we have to go through now in terms of uploading, how we do it with Kindle, and how, you know, and how doing the conversion and all that stuff, I think that will at some point be a thing of the past.
Wow, Quinn, that's incredible. I mean, that is really exciting. And I understand what you're saying, because I remember, like, years ago having a website, if you wanted to change the content or anything, you had to call your webmaster and, you know, at least for me, you know, they had to get in there. And then, you know, blogging came, you know, WordPress and Blogger. And actually, I started out with Blogger and then I moved into WordPress. And now I have, you know, I have somebody who hosts my site and we installed a custom WordPress theme. And I do find that to be one of the easiest to use, although I didn't have any issues with Blogger either. But I mean, it's really exciting what's happening. But I just want to take a step back and ask you, just from a marketing perspective with books, because I believe it or not, I bump into authors who are so resistant to starting a blog. I mean, do you feel that that is a sort of an absolute necessity as part of your marketing arsenal if you're an author trying to get your name and books out there?
Yeah. Well, Yeah, I mean, it's. I'm trying to pick my words very carefully because I certainly don't want to be offensive to anybody. The long and short, that the truth is, if you're not willing to market yourself and you're not willing to create a brand for yourself as much for your book, you're going to have a hard time being successful. And it doesn't mean you can't be, but those that like win the lottery, those are the exceptions, not the rule. And, you know, I think that there's different ways. You know, I personally am not a huge blogger. I do have a lot of social media sites, and I do share a lot of information and stuff, but I'm so busy that to take the time to actually sit down and write out an article, you know, once a week or something like that, I don't really have disposable time to do that. And so maybe there's a little bit of a communication issue where people think blog means I have to write an article every day. No, you don't have to do that. There's a lot. I think a blog, for me, in a lot of respects, is really showing your personality and who you are in the world. And so if you do have time and you want to, you know, write original content and put it up there, that's wonderful. But it's also really about sharing and exchanging and connecting with other people. And that's really the most important thing about blogging and social media networking. It's the connections we make and the stepping stones of how we do it. You know, sometimes in my career, I remember thinking that there were people that I meet, like, this is it. This is going to help me seal this deal. This is going to help me. And, you know, and nothing ever came of it. You just never know that the people that come into your life and how they may come into your life and who they can expose you to of what it can mean for you, your work, and your books. So it's really important to always be open to wanting to meet and connect with new people. I remember when I was first starting out, there was one woman in particular who I just absolutely adore and love, and she came back, and I guess she had gotten spammed or felt like she, you know, a lot of people always ask me to be friends. I'm like, why do you want to be friends with me? And so I just said, well, I wrote back very sincerely and said, I want to be friends with you because I think we have things in common, and no, I'm not trying to do anything. I'm not trying to sell you anything. And we ended up becoming great friends, you know, different part of the world, totally different backgrounds and stuff. And we stay in touch with each other as much as we can. So you just never know what will come from it. So it's I think it's a fear, don't you?
Oh, I think I'm just like so thrilled that technology has advanced to the point that it has today, that you can become friends with people. I mean, I've met people on Twitter that have become really close friends and have been helpful in some way, or I've been able to help them in some way. And it's just, it's incredible. But I do think you're absolutely right, Quinn, when you're talking about, like, I think engagement is the key that a lot of people kind of miss with social media, that it's not just about broadcasting. In fact, in my experience, broadcasting should be a small percentage of what you do. And when I say that, meaning broadcasting, like constantly telling people about yourself and your books, in this case, talking about authors, and more about engaging and asking people about them. And, you know, what do you think about that?
I think it's all about, I agree with what you're saying, and to me the word that comes up is collaboration. And collaboration, in a sense, is balance. It's about, yes, you're helping yourself, but you need to be helping others. You know, the best way to be of service, you know, I learned a lot of good things being raised as a Mormon girl. I will say that. But the service is very, very important. And, you know, without that, you know, what's the point? So I think, you know, anybody that I deal with, that I become connected with, I'm hoping will we can work with each other in a collaborative way. Now, I get a lot of people who, you know, send me stuff and do stuff all the time, and maybe some people feel that way about me, although I really try to be very conscientious about that. It doesn't bother me that people send me crap, and I'll tell you why. Because it's always good to see what somebody else is doing. And it's always good to see if somebody does come up with a new idea or has an idea that maybe you can tweak in a way that is helpful to you. Years ago, I remember going to, think of myself as an internet marketer. I don't really like that type of paradigm. But I remember going to one only years ago and people saying, the worst mistake you can make is actually never looking at your junk mail. If you want to see what's happening in cutting edge, you should at least look at it. You can always just delete it, but, you know, the mail that you get in, you know, people spend a lot of money writing that and developing that, and there may be some things in there that you can learn from. So I'm not saying you have to keep it, not saying you have to love it, but I don't think you should ignore it either, because that's just the world we live in. How do you feel about that? No, I think that's excellent advice. I'm listening to you and I'm sitting here shaking my head because I've known people who will discard things like that and just kind of, you know, write it off. And no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I've learned so much from so many people that I've met either through social media or through, you know, the contact button on my blog that have reached out to me. And everybody, I think you can find the value in things that are sent to you unsolicited. And I definitely agree with you on that point, Quinn. Absolutely. I wanted to talk a little bit, though, about, like, so when you work with people, do you work with authors and you consult with them in terms of, like, tell me about that process. Does it start when they send a query letter, and how does it go on from there? And what are the services that you offer for anyone listening that may want to learn more about that?
Okay. Well, I have two main websites. One's Wise Bear Media and the other's Wise Bear Books. The Wise Bear Media is really more... it was my imprint that I created to do my own books, and what happened was organically, without doing any marketing, is people, friends of mine, word of mouth, came to me and said, I want to do what you're doing. Can you help me or can you teach me? And I said, well, I'm kind of busy with my own stuff. I really don't really want to have a business doing formatting and conversion per se. However...
Yeah.
People kept coming to me, and I'm not a charity. I can't do it for free. And so what I did was I then created a website that when people came to me and said, okay, if you're really serious about this, go look at my website. Here's the ins and outs of it. And then if you're serious, come back and get and tell me. Because after years of doing website design, what generally happens is when you tell people everything that goes into it and what the time and labor and the expense that goes into it, a lot of people just run away. So it was really more put up there as almost a disclaimer to say, if you're really serious about this, I'll talk to you, but if not, you know, then go figure it out yourself. But from that, I actually have gotten, you know, a number of people who've come, and I actually have gotten publishers who've come to me and asked me to private label books for them so that I am doing the technical part, but they're slapping their label on it as if they're doing it. And that actually, I prefer that business model more than actually, I don't want to be anybody's publisher other than my own. But I call myself, if somebody comes to me and really wants to work with me, I call myself an e-publishing project manager. And that is, I look at all the things that need, the tasks that need to be done, and I make sure everything is properly executed. Now, to the extent that an author wants to do that and learn along with me, happy to teach them. To the extent they want me to do it, just do it for them, and I don't want to have to think about it, I can do that too. But I don't really market and try and push that side of the business. That's kind of just happened more by word of mouth, which is the best marketing dollar you can spend because it costs nothing. Now, as I was doing that and as I was doing my own stuff, I realized that one of the things I talk about in this Digital Publishing Profits book is kind of like, I think you and I are very like-minded in the sense of that, you know, I know what my strengths are, I know what my weaknesses are, and so I happen to be one of the few lucky ones in the world who's not afraid to speak in public settings and put myself out there. And so starting my Blog Talk Radio podcast was a way to, you know, market myself. But I could also be helping people as I do that. So Wise Bear Books was born out of, okay, here now I want to, you know, market, and I want to help other people market in a collaborative way. And so Wise Bear Books was born. And so there's three main pages on Wise Bear Books. Interviews, which is the podcast, reviews, which I do occasionally when I have time, will look and review books for other people. But right now I'm kind of on hiatus because of the third page, which is really about our Digital Book Awards competition, which we launched last September, and the deadline's coming up in April. And so that came about because I realized by looking at a lot of books that even with how we produce books now, that there's a lot of people and a lot of people who pretend to be, you know, formatters and converters who are not doing it properly. It's not enough to just put, you know, words on a Word document and call it a PDF and boom, you got an ebook, and then put it up on Kindle or Smashwords and think that it's going to be an enjoyable experience for people. So the Digital Book Awards was created with the idea that if we could really help evaluate and teach and advocate for what we hope to find are the best in, you know, the independent digital community. And it's been a huge learning curve and a big experience, and it's a lot of work. But we're very, very pleased with the caliber of books, by and large, the caliber of books that have signed up. We don't do a lot of marketing. Once again, it's mostly word of mouth. We believe that, you know, good businesses take time to evolve, so we're not going to try and pretend to be something we're not. And we're learning from this, and we'll improve upon it in future generations of the competition.
That's fantastic. Quinn, I'm looking at, for everybody listening, I'm at wisebearbooks.com, Quinn's website, /awards, which is where you have the guidelines listed for any independent authors and publishers who would like to be a part of it. And this is phenomenal. I think it's, you know, you're giving a voice to people who want to, submit their work and see if they can, you know, if they can achieve more awareness of their work and hopefully maybe even win one of your awards. I mean, I'm looking here and it says you have prizes valued up to $5,000. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, a lot of that, when we're talking about, the values and stuff like that, it's really what you get out of it is ultimately, our goal is to work individually with what we consider to be the biggest award winners to really help them promote their book for a long period of time and through, technology that we use that has, really helped, promote ourselves. And there's a lot of people out there who that no matter what you do, will say, oh, somehow we've gotten this idea that independent means charitable or free, and it's not.
Right.
It takes a lot of time and effort to create these things and bring the people in. And I knew going into this that there were there were going to be some people who would immediately, try and say, oh, this isn't good or this isn't right. But I think at the end of the day that the authors we're dealing with, let me put it this way. If somebody thinks that they're going to just sign up for an award competition to get a gold star, that is the wrong reason to sign up for any competition. Our intention is really to help authors and to really showcase, what is, what's best in digital publishing. However, if we do find things that are not really quite up to snuff, we use kind of the Kirkus model of our reviews, and that is, if there is a negative review, we do leave it up to you whether or not that review will ever see the light of day, and then we work with you to help improve upon that if you want. But we do not upsell our customers. We really are just trying to manage a competition that really helps get digital authors to the next level and prepare them for what's coming, what we talked about earlier on in the show.
Yeah, that's phenomenal, Quinn. I think, one of the values I think, too, just listening to you and kind of reading this over on your website is, too, that even though the stigma has kind of gone away, I think, for being a quote-unquote self-published author, I do think that, you as an author still have to hold yourself accountable in terms of being willing to, one, like hire an editor, two, like be able to accept constructive criticism and go through the same process, even though nowadays I think if you are published through a traditional publishing house, you still have to do a lot of the marketing. So I'm like, I think it's great that we have the ability to kind of go beyond that, but you still should be, as an author, be concerned about quality and be willing to expend the resources necessary to still produce something of value. And so, I just think this is great. Now, let me ask you, can these books, if somebody's listening and they want to submit something, does it have to be something new? I mean, can it be something they maybe self-published a few years ago? I mean, what are the just general guidelines for that?
Well, that's interesting you bring that up, because a lot of competitions do have kind of an expiration date. I don't know what we'll do in future generations of the competition. I've already decided that there are going to be some significant changes once we get past this particular period. So one of the things is I don't think there needs to be a deadline, because what's happening is, and in fact, I have a couple customers who are former best-selling authors who never had their work digitized. And the problem with digitizing something when you don't have a digital file to go off of, it's a very labor-intensive process. So there are some best-selling authors, you know, back from the 80s and 90s who are beginning to put their books out again. Is it really fair to exclude them from a competition like this? I don't think so. Not that, you know, I have droves and droves of books from the 80s and 90s coming here. I don't really care about that so much. I care about that, you know, the quality of the work. I care about, you know, let's put it this way. I'm not going to have repeat books coming in the next round. If your book's been evaluated once, that's it, you're done. But you haven't been evaluated, then the books, in my opinion, don't have an expiration date. You know, it's like a book that was written 50 years ago is still interesting now. A book that was written hundreds of years ago is still interesting now. Now, it's like some public domain things, that's not going to be a part of the competition. It has to be realistic. But for people who did write things, you know, 10, 20 years ago, who can now, you know, repurpose that content and find a new audience, why not?
Yeah, that's fantastic. I think that's awesome. Now, Quinn, where do you see, like, with you know, all these changes coming in technology and certainly all the advances that we've seen so far, do you ever see, you know, traditional publishing houses going away, or do you think they'll adjust and kind of move with the times? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
No, I don't think traditional publishing houses are going anywhere anytime soon, and I don't have any axe to grind with traditional publishers. They've served a very important purpose. What they need to do is they need to what I think is happening is they're shifting. They're now consolidating. There was an interesting article I read probably a couple weeks ago that we talked about it on my podcast, and where they talked about the digital revolution. Forget the title of the article was, but it was in a publication called The Scholarly Kitchen. And it was a very highbrow article, which, you know, readability-wise was, but it did make a good point. And I don't necessarily agree with it, but the point, I think it's interesting enough to pass along, and that is the revolution is over. We're really now about consolidation and finding solutions. And so the big publishers that are there, they have the wherewithal to really consolidate and bring in some of the startups that will help them kind of retool. Now, the problem that they have is they're kind of off to a late start. Stuff they should have been doing 5 years ago, they're finally waking up to them like, oh, this is for real, this isn't going away. And now they're trying to figure that out. But what I think the biggest competitions are going to have are not really from the Amazons of the world. It's going to be from these, you know, software development startups who are going to come up, create the new WordPress for books. And those companies are really going to be prime acquisition targets that will help the bigger publishers figure it out finally. You know, they're not going to start from scratch when they can hire somebody to do it for them, right?
Right. They have the resources, like you said, too. So why would they start from scratch, you know, rather than just,
why buy somebody? Yeah, let's buy the wheel. Let's not reinvent it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I can say just from my own perspective and that of, you know, several independent authors I know that I've just been, we're just very grateful, though, that we have, that we're living in an age of advanced technology where it is possible to self-publish and where it has become sort of an acceptable route to take, you know, as an author, because just, you know, whether it's the economy or for whatever reason, it seems like, you know, the traditional publishing houses, at least, you know, 5-6 years ago, well, I think it's still true today, you know, if you weren't a known quantity, if you weren't a celebrity or somebody well known that they knew, you know, that you were bankable, that they knew immediately they would get a return on their investment, they really weren't interested in cultivating new talent, even if you were the greatest writer that ever came along, because it just comes down to, and it's understandable, dollars and cents. But I think now with technology, things have been more democratized. But as I said, and I want you to kind of speak to this as well, that you still have to hold yourself, I think you as the author have to hold yourself to a very high standard. And I mentioned this before, because I know a lot of people that don't want to get an editor or they don't want to spend the time or even any kind of money that might be necessary to make sure that they're putting out a good product and take care of that whole marketing aspect of it.
Well, here's the problem with the whole, the editor proofreader thing. a lot of people can't afford it. And it's unfortunate, and I wish it weren't true, but it is. And there is actually a website that's been around for a couple of years called netminds.com. And it's a collaborative website where you can list what your strengths are as a writer, like maybe somebody is a good editor, somebody does this, and somebody does that, somebody's a project manager. And it allows you to kind of collaboratively work with different people of different skill sets and then produce your book. I think it's a great idea conceptually. Fundamentally, the problem I have with it is I'm not going to trust my book to somebody I don't know. But
right.
For somebody who maybe has to take that leap of faith because they don't have an alternative, it is a way that you can barter your services in exchange for somebody else's strengths. The other thing is that Guy Kawasaki talks about in his book, his latest book, Ape, I think that's author, publisher,
oh, I love him.
Yeah. He uses this idea of crowdsourcing. You know, the idea is that, and this is what I've done with my digital publishing profit book, although I wasn't the evangelist for Apple with a list of 5 million people. But what I did is I basically just put my book up there and I said, I want your feedback on this because books really aren't published anymore. They're released like software. And when you get enough feedback and, you know, glitch reports and bug reports, you can fix that and just have a new update. And so there's a mind, you know, something that has to shift this way. So there are things out there, and that's why it's really important to you know, I always say, you know, the second thing in my digital publishing process, no, my third thing is become a student of the industry you're involved in. Set up your Google alerts, digital publishing, self-publishing, any keywords that are important to you, and read those articles. Some of them are the same thing over and over again, but a lot. There's a lot of new stuff happening all the time. So if you want to know the trends and what's going on, read the articles. Even if it's you think it's too technical, you know, by osmosis, you'll begin to absorb some of it, and you'll be surprised how much you will learn. And the final point I want to make of what you just said is what we're also seeing emerge is this idea of hybrid authors. Have you heard that term before?
No, I have not. That's interesting.
Hybrid authors are essentially people who have been traditionally published or have been self-published who would then become traditionally published, and they use both the traditional publishing infrastructure as well as their own self-publishing tools to really maximize their profitability. I just had somebody on my podcast, I think it was last week, who's a traditionally published author, had 5 books published traditionally, actually makes, you know, there's a lot of people out there making money as writers who are best-selling authors who are not household names. So in between, like, the 2% of the big-name authors that we all know and the 2% of people who aren't going to do a darn thing, the rest of us live. And a lot of those people are good, hardworking authors who are eking out a living of sorts and are really about the business of selling books day after day. Now, what has come to light is that these hybrid authors seem to have struck the right balance. That the Wall Street Journal, there was a video link that I saw a few weeks ago about a new series called Wool. I'm not familiar with this series yet, but it's like the new Hunger Games, they're calling it. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I'm not familiar with Hunger Games, yeah.
Okay. So what they're saying is that this self-published author has so much power because through his own work he was able to sell tens of thousands of his own book, that when it came time to negotiate with the traditional publisher, he was able to maintain his own digital rights and only sell the print rights to them. That's unheard of in traditional publishing. So because they want to tie everything up. And the problem is when you sell the digital rights, you're totally at their mercy of what they want to do, and they are very, very slow. And yet, if you can have the exposure of, you know, having your books all over the place, all the better. Because, you know, this is one of the problems that's happening with Barnes & Noble. People go in, they use it as a showroom, and then they get out their smartphone and they buy the books online. And so there is a benefit to being in bed with a traditional publisher, if nothing else, from exposure. So the more that you're exposed, whether it's in the bricks and mortar world or it's all digitally, it's all good.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's nice to know that, I mean, I had not heard that. I mean, that's fantastic. It's nice to know that it's possible now to retain
you know, your digital rights and still get the benefits, as you said, of a traditional publishing house and get your book, you know, the physical book out there. That's really, it's good to know that that's happening.
I think this was a monumental thing that happened, and why the Wall Street Journal was, because that doesn't generally happen, and it probably won't happen for anybody. But if your book is popular, you have a lot of control and a lot of power over what happens. For the rest of us, who knows? But it, to me, it shows a trend that traditional publishing knows you're going to have to give a little bit. You can't control everything anymore.
Right. And the individual author can, you know, if they can, you know, produce something good and learn how to market it and achieve a certain level of success, then they're really empowering themselves to be able to do what, you know, what that author did that was featured in the Wall Street Journal. So I think it's a good lesson, too, about, you know, learning how to market yourself as well.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely.
So, yeah, and, you know, Quinn, one thing, too, you know, we talked about podcast, and you know, while I'm on that topic, let people know when they can listen. When you know, what's your Blog Talk Radio name, and when does your show go live, and how can people find it?
Blog Talk Radio, Wise Bear Books, all things digital media. You can just find us by looking for Wise Bear Books on Blog Talk Radio. We'll take you to our site, and we generally do shows every Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific. They are generally 30 to 45 minutes, this Friday, actually, I'm going to be out of town, and generally, I still do podcasts when I'm out of town, but I'm not going to be able to do it this week. But so our next show is going to be the week after that. I think that's March 31st. We'll be back live, and it's my business partner and I, TJ and Quinn, and we're not a live call-in show. We're really set up for that. We do encourage people, if they do have questions specifically that want to be answered on the show, to email us in advance, and we're happy to answer those questions, because sometimes people ask a question, it's like, well, I don't have the time to look it up right now. You know, Google is a wonderful tool for learning. But we try and balance our time between talking about some of the trends and the news and what's happening in the digital media world, and then we also have a guest that comes on, usually an independent author, who not only talks about and promotes their own book, but a lot of times we ask them to, if they want to participate in just talking about the news and media. You'd be surprised how many people really know more than they think they do. How many people say, oh, no, I don't know anything about that. I'm like, well, we'll throw you a few softballs. And then they really get into it, and they realize, oh, I know more than I think I do. And I think most people are really like that.
Yeah, you know, I was listening to one of your podcasts this morning, just briefly, because I was trying to get ready for the show today, but I wanted to kind of listen to part of it, and it's excellent, and I encourage everybody to tune in, because, I mean, Quinn, you offer so much information that, and it's great to have a place to go where you can just click a button, listen to a particular broadcast, you know, take some notes maybe while you're listening, and really be able to learn. I think there's so much value in what you're doing, especially for people, like I said, and this kind of, I think, describes most of the authors I know. They're fairly new to this whole process. So I encourage everybody to check out your show. And then, like, the other part of my question with that, and speaking of Blog Talk Radio and communication in general, is that I wanted to get your take on writers sort of, you know, especially shy ones, really kind of learning how to come out of that shell and be able to talk about their work, because I discovered, and so many people that I've interviewed have discovered, that people are just as interested in the author as they are in the book. And I'll just say this before I let you jump back in here. I had the experience one time of interviewing a wonderful author. She happened to be in the romance genre. Her books were wonderful. But interviewing her, and you know, I don't mean this in a, you know, to anything about her personally, but she really, it was like pulling teeth. It was one of the longest interviews I think I've ever conducted in my life. And so I just wondered if you could speak to the importance of authors being able, you know, and learning how to become more comfortable with expressing themselves either on Blog Talk Radio or in person.
Okay. A couple things go through my mind. I have had that experience that you've mentioned, and I used to always have a pre-show phone conversation with people because I wanted to know what I was getting myself into. And I honestly felt like, oh, I don't need to do that anymore, so I'm just, you know, I have them call in a few minutes before the show, we chat, but that has happened, and one of the reasons I actually have a co-host now. But here's the thing, the way I look at it, some of it is just personality, and asking people to change their personality is
you know, come on.
Yeah.
It's hard. That's a hard thing to do. But here's what I would say. You may get to the point where you are never comfortable, but you can get better at it. And so I used to teach a course in Business Development 101 that I called Birthing Your Business in the community college system here in Los Angeles. It was like a weekend thing that I, you know, did for a few years before I moved into other things. And the idea of the course was, and I remember when I first was pitching the idea of the course, Birthing Your Business, people looked at me like I was crazy. And I said, the whole idea of I want, my target market is women. And if you can raise a family, you can run a business because you're kind of doing that already. And so
yeah.
In my digital publishing profits book, I talk about the first thing you have to get your mind around is selling books as a business. And if you want to sell books and if you want people to know, one of the things you're going to have to do is you're going to have to talk about yourself. And so you may never feel 100% comfortable, but another analogy I use is there's all things in we may be passionate, we love what we do in terms of writing and selling books and stuff like that, but there's always some aspects of the job that, ugh, I hate doing that part. I love to cook. I don't like to unload the dishwasher. And I'm pretty neat and organized, but, oh, my gosh, I hate folding clothes. And so I use the analogy of when you have a task that you have to do and you know you need to do it for your own well, for your own good, is think of it like a big pile of socks and clothes. And how do you deal with that? You just take the first one out, and then you pull another one. And over time, you don't have to worry about some big strategy of how I need to do this. You just need to start. And do it simply, you know, and because you're making it harder than it actually is. And once you get into that, I have a business partner who's exactly like that. And now she's perfectly comfortable co-hosting the show with me, and she's brilliant, and she has lots of great insights that I don't have. And so having that different perspective is always valuable. So the more you do it, the easier it gets. And if you can come up with something in your mind that you hate to do, but you know you do it, and when you're done, it feels so much better, and kind of use that association, that is what I have found helps me. I know that's what other people, you know, kind of visualize the ending of it, you know, and not the fear surrounding it. And that's what I encourage people to do. I had this really sweet woman on my show, And I told her, and she just, you know, she just really suffers with it. And we've, you know, I had a few conversations with her, and I said, you just got to keep doing it. It will get easier the more that you do. And radio is so much easier than speaking in person. Nobody's looking at you. They may be rolling your eyes, and you don't know it, but what do you care?
Who cares, right?
Yeah. You know, and so it's really, it's easy for me to say this because clearly I'm not a shy person. But I do empathize with people who do have that, and I do have people around me who have that issue. And so it helps if you have somebody who can push you in a kind way. But the more you do, the easier it becomes. I mean, how do you advise people?
Yeah, Quinn, I mean, I'm listening to you, and I'm agreeing with you 100% because, you know, believe it or not, once upon a time I was one of those people who would rather have a root canal than get up in front of a room and talk to people or even get on Blog Talk Radio and talk to people. You know, and you know what really turned it around for me was back in 1998, I was actually working for Washington Mutual Bank, which doesn't exist anymore, but I was in the, you know, a corporate office in South Florida and in marketing, and I was a program manager. And at the time, you know, the bank was new here, and they don't exist anymore, but at the time they were new here, and I had to do a couple of presentations to, you know, some different branch managers. And so my boss was in the room for a few of them. And when it came time for my three-month review, she said to me, you know, you're doing an outstanding job. But she said, you know, the one thing I just want to talk to you about is, you know, don't get nervous when you're talking to people. She goes, you have information that they need. You have something that they need in order to do their job better. And Quinn, I don't know why, for some reason that finally clicked with me after years and years of being petrified to speak in front of people. But I don't know if maybe it was just her mannerism and the fact that overall she was a great person and a very mentoring type of boss. But that I had finally turned the corner after that. And in terms of Blog Talk Radio and just internet radio in general, I think that people, there's not a high, how do I say this? I mean, certainly you want to produce quality programming, but I don't think the pressure is as intense to be absolutely perfect. I think people who listen to internet radio are attracted to you know, more naturally sounding people. And, I mean, you've heard me. Sometimes I get so excited or thinking so many things are going through my head that I'm stumbling over my words at times. But, you know, I don't think people expect perfection with internet radio. As long as you're producing a quality show and interviewing quality people, I don't think you have to be 100% perfect either.
No. In fact, I think that's what draws people. I mean, you have such an endearing, infectious personality. And, yeah, on one hand, we're a society that loves to see people's grip a little bit too much, but, you know, it's the imperfections that really draw us to people. It's not that how perfect we are. That was in the 50s and 60s, this idea that everything had to be, you know, the illusion of perfection and stuff like that. I think that we have thrown that out. And so not everything has to be perfect. I know there's some people when they read books, yes, there are definitely some independent books where people could take a little bit more time to really, you know, make sure that, you know, what they're putting out, you know, isn't a bad experience. I'm trying to be kind here. But on the other hand, if I do see a book and there are a couple typos, I don't lose my, you know, lose my mind over it either. You know, even in best-selling books, I've found mistakes. You know, I find little typos and stuff like that. It's not the end of the world to me. Some people, whoo, you know, they just lose it. I don't. So
yeah, I'm like
that
you.
Doesn't bother me at all. But I think what you're saying, and probably what switched for you is how somebody approached you, like in a very mentoring, you can do it encouraging type of way. That's a great story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She was phenomenal. And it's like I said, it was just the thing I needed to hear, and it finally got through to me after years of struggling with it. So it's important, you know, for people on the other side who have now, like you were saying, you know, you never had that problem, but you've always had empathy for people who did. And I still do, too. I mean, I was just bringing up that example of that person because it reminded me of where I was, you know, not so long ago, and just the need to – I guess my gratitude that I had somebody that came along that really helped me get over it, because I think it also helped me in my professional life, and certainly in marketing my book, you know, a few years back, because so many people just wanted to hear, they wanted me to talk. I mean, they you know, and I think it's true for a lot of authors that I speak with, that people are just as interested in them, and sometimes even more so than they are in the book. So you have to learn how to overcome that shyness or that reticence to talk with people.
Oh, I'm fascinated with, especially after I read a book, that's one of my favorite things about what I'm doing now. It's like, where did you come up with that? What were you thinking? Or how did that come about? And it's amazing how many people, you know, just kind of like, I don't know. It just kind of came to me. You know? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, it is. I'm also fascinated by the fact that the writing process is so unique and it's such an individual experience. I mean, there's certain commonalities, you know, at times, but I love hearing individual authors' experience of how a particular book, you know, how it came about, where they got the idea, and how it all played out, because I don't think any two experiences are exactly the same, and you can always learn from, you know, what somebody did. Like, I have authors who will say, well, you know, from this time to this time, I just write. And other people are just like, no, I wasn't that rigid. You know, I wrote kind of when, I mean, I certainly set aside time every day, but I wasn't that rigid with it. And the end result is the same for both authors. They come up with great books, but the process is different. And so, you know, I love to talk. I could talk to people all day long about that.
Oh, yeah. I think that all authors, the one common thread we all have is, there's an element of synchronicity that goes into creating something like a book, especially in fiction, you know, and it's just like, you know, sometimes it's like almost like a dream you had, like when it's done, you know, here you have this lucid dream and then you have this book and like, I know I wrote this and I remember, but it's like, I'm not quite sure exactly it, you know, there's almost like something happens and it's always interesting to me how most writers have that kind of shared experience and or things happen at the right time in the right way for the right reasons. Do you feel that too?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, I wish, you know, the process for my first book as opposed to the sequel that I've been like working on now for like the last 3 years are so different. It was, you know, and I don't know, we're running kind of low, but I'll just say that it was a conversation with somebody that sparked all these memories that I didn't know what to do with, which inspired me to sit down in front of my computer, and 4 months later I'd written this book, and because it's loosely autobiographical, my first book. The second one, I'm taking the same characters, you know, and the two main characters, and I'm working them into a sequel, but now I'm having to make things up, and I certainly know what's going to happen, but the process is so different, whereas with the first book, it just flowed out of me. I couldn't stop myself from typing, which was a wonderful experience. But I don't think I'm ever going to repeat that experience again. Certainly, I've been in the, you know, all writers can attest to being in the flow and, you know, when things are running smoothly. For me, my whole first book was like one big, long, flowing just experience, whereas this one is kind of like, you know, yeah, some days it really comes to me and other days I'm dealing with writer's block. And so it's just funny how, you know, it can be so different, those experiences. But certainly the first experience of them I'll be eternally grateful for. Go ahead. What do you think about that?
Books are like children. You know, you love them all the same but a little differently. And, you know, your first book is like, you know, your first love. You know, it's like once you've had that experience, you can't really replicate it exactly. And yet, you know, most of us in our first love, you know, a lot of people did end up with their first love, and that's wonderful and great, but a lot of us, it's like, oh, my goodness, if I'd ended up with my first love. You know, we learn a lot more. We're smarter. We're more knowledgeable in how, you know, we put things together, and the mistakes we made in the first time, it's less innocent. You know, the curtain's been pulled back a little bit, and so the mysteries of it all aren't there. But it's still, for me, it's still very much an enjoyable process, and I feel like I'm more productive and efficient than the first time, you know, where you're kind of out in the middle of the ocean without, you know, land in sight and, you know, flailing around in the white caps. So there is something to be said for having a bit more experience and feeling. I still find myself in, you know, in flow in certain things, and they just come. And I find that when I'm writing collaborative, working on reviews too, I can write anything and it just kind of just, I can feel it when it's good. I think the main litmus test, if you are an author and you go back and read your own work and like, oh, you know, you grimace a little bit, that's not good. You know.
Yeah.
Because rarely, I mean, if an author system says, oh, that's pretty good, follow that intuition. Because we are so self-critical, most of us are so self-critical, mm-hmm. that we really do know kind of what's good and not good. The only difference is, has it been written in a way, you know, the real greatness in a book is not writing it the first time, it's rewriting it till it's ready, you know, and that's, I think, a big mistake too, even more than editing and proofing. A lot of people just want to get their book out to market. No, you have to spend time with that book, and you need to know those characters, and you don't really get to know those characters till you've been through it at least two or three times, in my opinion.
Yeah. True. Well, my gosh, Quinn, I can't believe our time is already up, and I really enjoyed talking with you. I hope you'll come back again in the future. But before we go, let everybody know again, I know they could find you at wisebearbooks.com. Can we also find you on social media, and what are the best ways to reach you?
Yeah, all of my websites have social media links, and I want to thank you so much for having me. You really do a wonderful job, and I think that the service that you're providing in the community is really wonderful. But yes, you can find me on all of my websites, and even at quinnbarrett.com goes to an About Me page with all the links to all of my websites. And so Wise Bear Books, quinnbarrett.com, and you'll find me on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. I do have a Tumblr blog, you know, so I'm pretty much everywhere you need to be when you're in the business of writing.
Excellent. Well, Quinn, thank you again for joining us, and I'll look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
Likewise.
Take care. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was WriteStream Tuesday for March 19th, 2013. I know I thoroughly enjoyed both of my interviews today with these wonderful guests. And to everyone who will be listening into the archives, thank you for your support. To anyone who listened live, certainly thank you for joining me today. Please join in the WriteStream Twitter chat this Thursday, 11 a.m. Eastern. When my guests will be at Budapush. That's Budapush Publishing. And until then, we'll see you till Thursday. Have a great day, everybody. Keep on writing and stay in that flow of creativity.